This will prove the point that Norm and I did not talk about our presentation, so there is some overlap between what he's talking about and what I wanted to present today. But mine's kind of looking at the entire spectrum of our programs, talking a little bit about the climate hubs, as well as the building blocks. And just to put a frame in, and obviously we beat on this point a lot, is that climate change impacts are occurring, and you know they're revealing themselves in a number of ways that impact farming and ranching and forested lands. So this is kind of what Norm was talking about. U.S. agriculture right now, from the EPA calculations, contributes about a little less than 10% of the total greenhouse gas emissions. And you can see this is the chart from that. So the nitrogen from ag soil management is one of the big components. Enteric fermentation and manure are two other big ones. And so you can see that we can play a role in terms of agriculture making an impact on total greenhouse gas emissions. So when we look at what, you know, impacts agriculture and what we ought to be doing in terms of all of our programs, we can either touch on the mitigation aspect of things, which is kind of what the nutrient management and the building blocks are all about, or adaptation. And I think between parts of what I'll talk about this afternoon, as well as the follow-up presentation on this new adaptation manual that the climate hubs are releasing, we'll probably cover the spectrum of, you know, what NRCS and USDA in general are trying to accomplish. So, you know, this talk is really going to focus on our conservation programs, touch on that a little bit, somewhat on the climate hubs, as well as the building blocks as well. Now, just a few words on our USDA programs and how they operate. As Norm discussed, you know, they are a voluntary, that we work with farmers and ranchers on a one-on-one basis, either providing them technical or financial assistance. And one of the great emphasis areas right now is increasing our partnerships. So our conservation innovation grants, as well as our regional conservation partnership programs, are really cost matching, that we're trying to not only provide funds for large-scale projects on a single basis or a regional basis, but in more or less get some cost share going on with that as well. And one thing about it, all this funding comes out of Washington, D.C., and so the amount of money that's given to a state through all our conservation programs, and I believe our EQIP funds is something like $1 billion a year that goes out to the states, but actually how that's used on an individual basis is decided on by the states or our local partners. So how that money gets spent on what types of conservation practices are really driven then by the local conservation priorities in that. Now, the climate hubs are a great extension for everything that we've been trying to accomplish, because they are really helping us increase the delivery of the conservation as well as our production assistance. So much of the, you know, the think tank might be the climate hubs, where they're taking a lot of the research information and generating it into a product that can be delivered out to the farmers and ranchers. But a lot of that delivery is going to be counted on by our USDA service centers. So those are our NRCS service center employees or FSA employees or rural development, as well as extension personnel, as well as crop advisors and others. So, you know, we're really, the hubs are kind of a center point for a partnership with a large range of people. And that's all they're really meant to be, is to garnish this information and help our farmers and ranchers do a better job with whatever information that might be available. But we're trying to integrate this climate change into existing USDA planning and programs. And the hubs are really trying to develop some assistance or support to our staff. So part of that, is one thing we recognize as part of the strategy that we need to tackle, is really increasing our internal knowledge of climate change to our employees. You know, they need to know more about adaptation and mitigation, the building blocks. You know, as while we're talking about it this afternoon, when I travel and go out to some of the field offices, they're not quite familiar with all these national programs that the Washington think tank is generating. So we need to communicate some of these ideas to them. And they really struggle with discussing climate change with farmers and ranchers. You know, there's been a lot of studies going on with what's the relative amount of belief of farmers and ranchers and landowners in terms of climate change and the real reasons for that occurring. And so we need to work with what the knowledge level of our farmers are, as well as their belief systems, in order to be able to communicate on some of these climate-related discussions. Now, back in 2014, this gets a little into the building blocks that Norm talked about, but President Obama decided that by 2025, we're going to reduce our overall greenhouse gas emissions. There's actually another proposal within Washington, a new strategy to actually drive these closer to, you know, a much higher amount than it is now. So this is kind of what they felt was realistic at the time, but, you know, I've been watching some of these programs, and you start to really believe that we need to, you know, reduce our energy sectors almost to a climate neutral, you know, where there's zero emissions of CO2 if we're really going to turn climate change around. But within USDA, obviously, we are emitters of greenhouse gases, and so there's ways that our farmers and ranchers can address this, either by storing carbon or reducing emissions. And a large part of this goes to our existing programs that are already taking place and just sort of retweaking and reemphasizing how they can benefit the producers out in the field. So this is the same chart that Norm showed. I guess what I wanted to emphasize is how NRCS has personnel involved in a large part of these building blocks. Some of those, in the end, where we're not really involved are the Forest Services leading most of those efforts. But you can see that the soil health, the nitrogen stewardship, livestock partnership, and so on, we do have personnel involved in all of these. So we're really trying to play a role in these building blocks. And part of that is not only developing the ideas, but getting that information out to our own employees to better understand what we're doing and the jobs that they're going to be tasked with. Because it's really our field personnel that we're going to be asking to carry the load when we actually want to start making some of these changes. And our conservation practices are really a focus of these building blocks. So this is the list of ones that we've basically put together for soil health. And over on the right-hand side are just some greenhouse gas mitigation potentials developed from Comet Planner. So Colorado State and Adam Chambers and others have been working on Comet Farm. Comet Planner is kind of a quick resource guide then towards understanding some of these mitigation potentials. And these are some of the values based on really limited studies that they understand what they might be. But it just gives you an idea that each of our conservation practices have some way then for increasing carbon in the soil or reducing energy consumption. You know, there's big holes in all of this. You know, there's a lot of research needs to take place. One is just the environmental impact of our conservation practices. What are the benefits as well as limitations? When we're recommending these out to farmers and ranchers, you know, which ones are the best ones? You know, which ones have the greatest impact and such? And we don't really have a good handle on these, especially when we're looking on a regional or ecosystem basis. You know, we really know that, you know, yeah, we can build carbon with cover crops, but do we really know the impact in different regions with the different kinds of cover crop systems and that sort of thing? So we really need also then to develop some really spatially explicit analysis of the cost benefits. Because, you know, I've looked at some ERS data recently in terms of cover crop implementation across the different regions of the United States. And I think in the Midwest, you know, it's like ranges from 5 to 10% of acceptance by farmers and their use. And I guess I was a little aghast, but I live in Nebraska, and I've taken some trips driving. I drove down to Oklahoma on one last winter, and I've been across, you know, Iowa and some of the states going east over the wintertime as well. And you can see that we have a long ways to go in terms of really bringing this to a forefront and getting people to sort of believe that some of the stuff that we preach from our soil health standpoint is really going to not only be cost beneficial, but increase the productivity of their systems. So it's one thing is how does it benefit the farmer? and you know, and profitability is probably one of their first and foremost things to keep in mind. So we really need to know the cost benefits of some of these practice implementations. The other thing is, especially in terms of these building blocks, is kind of the refocus some of our financial and technical assistance. And our chief had a special allocation of some EQIP funds this winter, and we put it out to the states. It was about $72 million, where it was really directed at some greenhouse gas beneficial conservation practices. And it was really dictated to the states that they need to look at some of the existing conservation plans and target these funds through those plans that actually have some mitigation or carbon building potential built within them. Part of the other thing that you could look at is our EQIP ranking criteria. You know, a lot of this is governed by the states. You know, when we're looking at distributing these EQIP funds for various practices, well, maybe we could target, you know, carbon-rich soils to look at plans that, have building carbon in some of these more vulnerable landscapes like, you know, riparian areas or wetlands or just histosols. We might be able to sort of favor those types of soils in terms of some of our EQIP funding. Another one that's been brought up to me is, you know, we could tweak our EQIP funding so it favors anaerobic digesters because of just the expense and trouble of those as well. One thing Norm really emphasized is the partnerships that we need to bring in vogue and help in this overall effort. So they really are successful or key to the success of some of these building blocks. In terms of anaerobic digesters, we need to partner not only with the nonprofits and NGOs, but industry as well, because of the cost of some of these digesters, which are going to be basically trying to mitigate some of the methane emissions. We need help to do that. One thing that was pointed out to me when I kind of asked questions from a large number of people, they said, we have a small soil health division. Yeah, they're doing great things. They're getting out there, but we're really not having the impact down into the state level. And really what they suggested is we need to do is build more producer groups and soil health networks. And one I try to help a little bit through some funding is in California. They're creating one of these networks. But we also have some ones that are ongoing down in Oklahoma and other locations. But it's really, if we're trying to bring soil health to the farmer, the best way to do that is has demonstration plots in their areas or local farmers that can be championing some of these practices, because if they see the importance of some of those and understand the cost benefits, they're more likely to accept it. And with that, I just want to say thank you, and I'm just trying to bring some of these ideas of everything from the building blocks to the climate hubs and how we're trying to approach these climate change impacts in general. Thank you.
Okay, maybe one question and then you can move on to your next.
All right. Sure.
So earlier, this afternoon, presentation about CRP land and it's going. Farmers are converting CRP land, or at least to that, and putting it in crop production, and that seems to go against.
Well, this conservation of sensitive lands are one of those building blocks. One of the aims is trying to take some of the CRP land and convert it into easements. And so, I had a call from the Land Trust Alliance a month or so ago, which is sort of a agglomeration of land trust groups and sort of their one of their overall umbrellas. And so how can they be used in terms of going and providing outreach to farmers with some of the CRP land and trying to convince them that maybe, think about some agricultural easements or other types of easements on that. And, and one thing that I've heard recently, and which is sort of interesting, I've been sort of aghast of wondering why easements in terms of total acres are going down in some of these farm bills. I think this last one, it went from 36 million acres down to 24 over time as this farm bills went on. But, part of the issue here is the cost to our government funds for providing money to CRP, which takes it out of the land. It costs us a lot per acre to put money in CRP, and it's taking land out of production. So I think to some degree they're looking at trying to focus some of this government funding back into working lands at a really a reduced rate compared to what CRP is. And that was sort of surprised me because I was like, gosh, we need more CRP, we need more easements. But in terms of government funding, that's a difficult thing to do when there's a limited amount of money going around.